world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Wouldn't it be weird if a political pollster were asking a person what they thought of Harry Truman? And they said, oh, I thought he was a wonderful man. He lied all the time. He was a great man. He was a wonderful man, filled with love. Of course, he never accomplished anything that he really said he did. He pulled the wool over the eyes of the general public. Everything that he claimed he'd accomplished was sheer fraud. But what a marvelous man he was, and I really believe on him. Of course, I don't accept a word that ever came out of his mouth. I think every choice and every decision he made was completely fraudulent, fake, a lie. I think probably he was a cheat and a hypocrite, and he really wasn't who he said he was, but I sure do believe on him, and he's a wonderful man. Wouldn't that be a weird conversation? Actually, that is the conversation without really coming out and being that honest about it, that many people who profess belief in Jesus Christ would very likely say, I mean, if they could just come up with that complete objectivity. If they were answering a pollster, what did you think about a person who used to live, you know, but who had died? Millions of people talk about belief on Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ and his name is so absolutely a part of our Western civilization, you can be walking along the street and hear people talking about Jesus Christ. But they're cursing. They might as well say Melvin McGillicuddy. It would do them just as much good. Matter of fact, it would probably do them a lot less harm, because what they're doing is going out of their way, we people do this, we human beings, planet Earth, to find out what our Creator tells us not to do, and then to deliberately do it as if it is a challenge to His existence, as if by cursing the air blue, we're proving to ourselves that there is no God up there capable of really exacting any retribution, and therefore we go on our smug conceits that we can live our lives unimpeded, unfettered, by any ritualism, by traditionalism, by any religion that really has any hold on our lives, that makes us do what it says, any worship which really requires of us a way of life. But the name of Jesus Christ is everywhere present. It's certainly part and parcel of the announcements of sermons on the Saturday church page, on the street corners, and the placards, and the signs that are there. It's on the skivvy shirts of the hippies and the vagabonds along the roads these days. It's written on cars and rocks and barn tops. It's talked about by world-famous evangelists and presidents in prayer breakfasts. It's talked about by little people and large and small, by the rich and the poor. Jesus Christ is a name with which practically everyone is familiar. Isn't it strange, then, that the central fact of the Bible, which made Jesus the Christ, which is the fact of His resurrection, is held to be very unimportant by many very large church organizations, is cheerfully admitted by many large church organizations to be a non-essential point of their doctrine, is cheerfully admitted by many a preacher type to be something that they don't really emphasize in their sermons. Yet, at the same time, it is supposed to be an historical event, is supposed to be something which can be historically demonstrated and proved beyond the shadow of a doubt, and more importantly, was supposed to be the test as to whether or not Jesus really was, and therefore is, if He was resurrected, the Christ, as opposed to just being an anybody or a nobody. So I don't think it's an unfair analogy. Of course, I don't think anybody has ever said that of Harry Truman, but it would be weird if they did, just as it is weird for people to say they believe on Jesus and they adore Him. And isn't it nice to know the Lord? And they talk about the little Lord Jesus and the Lord this and the Lord that. But when it gets right down to, well, but did He really heal all those people? Did He really produce all those miracles? Did He really walk on water? Did He really change water into wine? Did the fig tree really wither? Did He feed the 4,000 and the 5,000 with the tiny little baskets of fish and bread? Did He really heal the centurion's son or servant, as the case may be? What about the crippled man at the well? And what about Lazarus? Was he raised from the dead? What about the casting out of the money changers in the temple? What about all the many things that Jesus was supposed to have done? Oh, well, now, we can't go along with that, because you know how those gospel writers probably exaggerated, people say. But we sure adore Jesus. Or they come back with it. Well, now, we know that He wasn't born on or anywhere near December 25th, but you wouldn't want to take the Christmas spirit away from people, would you? We have these wonderful, quaint little human reasonings of ours that God says are so futile that he says are so absolutely, abysmally ignorant on our part that we ought to begin wondering far more of what does God say, and attaching more importance to what God says and what Christ says and what Christ thinks than what we say and what we think. So in the short series of programs on that central fact that made Jesus the Christ, which is the resurrection from the dead, I have been submitting the resurrection account to the standard proof for historicity of anything that is supposed to have occurred in the past. And I said that there are four major rules. I want to rehearse that right quickly, get into it, and complete that right now on this program. Last time I showed the critical rules for proving the reliability of historical events are these. First, eyewitness accounts have got to be taken at certain kind of face value, notwithstanding our doubting of eyewitnesses today, as being the most accurate. If a person was contemporaneous and wrote about the events when he lived back 1900 years ago, or 38 years ago, or 14 years ago, you would certainly tend to at least want to read what he said about what he saw, more than listening to the courthouse steps and barber chair philosophers of today who reason about what they think somebody thought he saw. So this is the first rule. The second rule is that there may be more than one witness. If you can muster more than one witness who saw the same event and read what he wrote, and you can read many different accounts from people who were standing at different points of view, you know, like on the NFL playback, you get the instant playback, and sometimes they show you the scene from the sidelines, and sometimes from overhead in the blimp, and sometimes from the end zone, and you really get the total picture then. If you're in the stands, you're only going to see it from one point of view. But just like an historical account, if you see it from several different points of view, you can superpose the one story over the other, you can add them all up like an arithmetic problem, and you can find out pretty much what is the truth. I covered this last time, so this is by way of rehearsal. The third rule: when many contemporary witnesses of an event are put on trial for their very lives concerning their veracity, and if they lose their lives determined that what they saw was true, it's awfully hard to discount that. People don't, by the dozens, by the hundreds, and by the thousands, give their lives under absolute agony of torture for something they know to be a patent fraud. I think a certain amount of human logic and objectivity has to be found in historical reasoning. The fourth rule: when normally hostile witnesses agree in their account, then you're beginning to get a little more veracity too. When contemporary witnesses who would normally be hostile to the event and to the personality surrounding it, I'm talking about Christ and his alleged resurrection from the dead, then you would think that credibility becomes surer, because even when hostile witnesses and people who had no reason to tell the truth about it all give credulity to the account by what they say, it becomes surer and surer. So these are good rules. And I want to show you again, by way of quick rehearsal, how each one of these rules is applied in looking at, say, the very first of the Gospels, which is the Gospel according to Matthew, who was an eyewitness account of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead.
The Ambassador College publication, What is the True Gospel?, addresses one of the most divisive questions of our time. We live in a world of many different religions. While teaching peace and harmony among men, their people are led to war against one another. Witness the long-standing Hindu-Muslim conflict, the Jew-Arab crisis, and the Protestant-Catholic confrontation in Northern Ireland, all believing they have the true religion. Ironic, isn't it? With over 400 denominations in the Western Christian world, haven't you ever wondered which one is right? Who teaches what Jesus taught? This free booklet helps you understand that message in the light of today's world. What is the True Gospel? Your copy is free. There's no charge or follow-up. What is the True Gospel? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
The man called Matthew, who wrote the first book of the New Testament, and some people think it is the very first book written historically, and they think maybe the Apostle Paul's letter to the Church of Thessalonica, called 1 Thessalonians, may have been, but many feel that Matthew was. It was written approximately 35 years after the events that it describes. When you subject this book of Matthew and all that it says about the many miracles of Christ, his birth, The stories that people repeat at Christmas time and all these things are written by Matthew, as well as many of the other gospel writers, Mark, Luke, and John. You know their names, I think. Well, you might not. Some people don't, but that's their names anyhow. Matthew was a well-known official in the city of Capernaum. He was a tax collector, not very well liked by a lot of people, but well known, nevertheless. Now, Matthew wasn't necessarily an evil man. He wasn't a man who was disliked because of any chicanery or dishonesty on his part. As a matter of fact, he was chosen to become Christ's disciple because of certain qualities of character, which certainly included absolute honesty. Now, the fact of Matthew's account, writing about events that occurred this many years before, being contemporaneous with people who were still alive, who had witnessed those events, has got to be taken into account, as we covered last time. He would have left himself open to very severe criticism, writing about the feeding of 4,000 and 5,000 people, for example, on two different occasions, writing about many, many people who had been healed when some of those people were still walking the earth alive, when thousands of people who had heard Christ, seen Christ, who had talked with him, some of whom had been healed by him, were still there. Matthew could not have gotten away with writing a thorough documentation of taking to hand the problem of setting in order the entire account of the beginning of Christ's birth, his ministry, his entire preaching and teaching, the events of the trial and his death and burial, and the testimony concerning his resurrection, and go unchallenged when there were tens of thousands of people still alive who knew of some of those events almost as well as Matthew did. So this is a point of history to consider. He was a well-known official tax collector in the commercial city of Capernaum on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he wrote about many activities of Christ in his own hometown area. So many people were alive when Matthew wrote who could have verified or denied the account. All right, a modern parallel that I said last time would have been somebody writing about a great man who had performed many miracles, maybe in a public square in New York City, and who had been killed. He wrote about it about 35 years or so later. There were tens of thousands of people who saw it personally, millions who might have witnessed it on television. He couldn't get away without being labeled an absolute fraud, not by one person, but by thousands of people, if he said that such and such an event had occurred, when in truth it did not occur. You have to take that into account. The second rule, there were many eyewitnesses, not just one. Jesus was executed in the eyes of not only some of his disciples, most of them fled and were way off somewhere watching it from a distance, if they were even around at all. But Jesus also underwent the trial in what would have been likened to the Supreme Court of his day, that's the Sanhedrin. He was brought before what would be the equivalent of the Archbishop of Canterbury, so far as the leader of the church, which was Caiaphas, the high priest of the nation. He was judged by Pilate, the Roman governor, which would be just like being judged by the prime minister of a country such as Great Britain. And finally, he was examined by a person no less than the stature of the king of Britain, or the queen as it might be. He was examined by Herod Antipas, who was the son of Herod the Great, who would have been the king of the Jews. This would have been similar to a king of England witnessing his trial. So not only were the common people of Jerusalem and the area of Palestine witnesses to the events surrounding the crucifixion, but so were the highest of the nobility. People representing actually three levels of government: the Jewish religious leaders, the occupational authorities, and those of Rome and their delegates themselves. So top authorities were exposed to what was going on. Now, thousands of people in Palestine came to believe the resurrection account. Not a one of them rejected it, denied it, or in any way wrote against it. The only story being that the gospel account itself reveals there was a false story which was deliberately bribed, was perpetrated by bribery, which was that his disciples stole the body away. We'll take issue with that in a few moments and find out whether or not we can believe that today. Now, actually, the New Testament books are all, in a sense, contemporary with one another, written in the same era from about, say, 50 A.D. or thereabouts on up through about 90 to 92 A.D., a very short period of approximately 40-some years, and the entire New Testament, 21 of the New Testament books, were written, and they covered about 37 to 40 years of activities, and they all agree with each other. They support and substantiate each other. They do not disagree with each other. So the third rule is the conviction of the apostles. Getting back to the issue, do people give up their lives for what they know to be lies? Now, even if they swear by a blood oath, and even if they take a solemn pact that they're going to start some fake religion, you'd think that out of these hundreds of people, somebody is going to cop out. That somebody, under pain of death and right on the rack of torture, being sawn asunder, thrown to lions in an arena before screaming Romans, which they were. Even the Apostle Paul said that he was fighting with beasts at Ephesus, and the strong inference is that he himself may have been cast into an arena and tossed a short sword and go at it with lions or ox, bulls, or whatever they had in there in the way of a wild beast that he was supposed to fight. So the idea that hundreds of others, as well as the apostles, gave their lives for what they knew was an outright lie is simply untenable when you try to use objectivity. Now, it's related in the Gospel of Mark, a gospel which many scholars say was written through the inspiration of Peter, that all the apostles, including Peter himself, fled the crucifixion scene. They did not remain anywhere in the vicinity of Jerusalem during that time, and they weren't found among the Jewish and the Roman authorities. This defection and this flight from the scene of Christ's crucifixion is a very important key for your logic and your rationale a little later on. What caused the incredible sudden reversal? Now ask yourself this point. The Gospels themselves are pretty hard on their heroes. The Bible is very, very hard on its heroes. It exposes the sins, the flaws, the faults, the appetites, the compulsions, the physical pressures, the inadequacies, the lack of faith, the doubts of its heroes. It exposes the fact that every last one of those closest men, including John, whom Jesus loved, and vice versa, fled when Christ was about to be killed. Yet later on, they would walk out of an area where they had been lashed to the bone and their ribs showing, singing songs, grateful to have been privileged to be so beaten for the sake of Jesus Christ. Yet he wasn't anywhere around then, apparently. What changed their minds? Do men, on the one hand, flee in great fear of physical pain, of torture, and then a matter of days or weeks later have got such courage that they're willing to go out and give their lives on a torture rack to suffer excruciating physical pain without some incredible phenomenon, some very important event, which so convinced them, which so loaded them with courage, that they were able to do so? Think about that. What event could that have been to have so completely changed their minds?
Wouldn't it be nice to buy just one gift at the
best time? Many doctors recommend. For further information on buying and selling gold, consult any bank.
And it's absolutely free.
The human mind is constantly bombarded with ideas. Some good, some bad.
Hearings were scheduled to conclude today.
The opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent...
Federal law requires a substantial interest penalty.
All you gotta do is buy two.
You're responsible for making the right choices.
And at reasonable prices.
Void where prohibited by law.
No purchase necessary.
Plain Truth helps you unjangle the conflict of ideas in our over-communicated world. This monthly publication offers straightforward insight and understanding. Proving which ideas in this world are valuable and which are not is your responsibility. Plain Truth can help. Request your subscription today. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Look at this fact of the Gospels, then, that originally, during the crucifixion scene itself, here were these men who had been with Jesus Christ in a very personal, deep relationship with him all of this long period of time, who were hiding out. And then the Bible goes on to say, in the Gospel accounts, that they were hiding behind closed doors during the time when Jesus himself is said to have appeared to them, and they were hiding for fear of the Jews, it says. Now, you look into the beginning chapters of the book of Acts, and what do you see? That the event on Pentecost, a required solemn assembly for those people. There were three great assemblies during the year, the Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles, during which time the city of Jerusalem was absolutely loaded with visitors from all over the nation of Israel at that time, or of Palestine, or Judea, Galilee, etc. Now here we see in the book of Acts, these very same men who just a matter of 30 to 40 days previously are hiding out in closed doors, walking around, talking whispers, trying their very level best to lose themselves in the crowd and not to be recognized by anybody. And yet suddenly they're up there on a platform, standing before thousands of Jews, people who had come there for Pentecost from all over the Eastern world, from provinces all over what is modern-day Turkey, the Peloponnesus of Greece, and all over toward, you know, Italy and all those nations that we think of, the nations today, Albania, Greece, Italy, etc., and these were the ancient names. They were strangers, it says, Greeks, Jews, strangers, proselytes, and so on, out of all different kinds of countries were there. And here are the apostles standing up and with great power giving witness unto the resurrection of Christ. How? What changed them all of a sudden? 3,000 people came to believe in the resurrection of a dead man that feast of Pentecost, a total change in attitude, and no longer feared or doubted, but suddenly had a great deal of power. Furthermore, they jeopardized their lives to preach Christ's resurrection. I can show you that by turning to it right quickly. And let me do that right now. I hadn't intended to, but let me just real quickly remind you. It seems like only a matter of a few weeks ago that I was going through some of these scriptures in the beginning of the book of Acts. Here in the second chapter of the book of Acts, the very first recorded sermon by the Apostle Peter, he said in verse 24, whom God has raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible he should be holden of it. This is a part of that sermon, that God had raised up Jesus Christ. He went on to talk about David being both dead and buried, and how he had not ascended into heaven. But he said in verse 32, this Jesus has God raised up, whereof we are all witnesses. That was a part of the sermon that Peter was giving on that day of Pentecost, the very first recorded sermon in the Bible. A little later on, in the very same chapter, talking about the resurrection. Well, let me see. They were, verse 41, 3,000 people added to them in that one day. There were that many that were so convicted by the preaching of Peter that they repented and they wanted to become a part of this. They wanted to believe in it. They wanted to have faith in a resurrection. In the third chapter, and beginning in verse 15, and killed the Prince of Life. I'm breaking right in the middle of the thought to get this one central theme, these few central words across. Whom God has raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses. Now, I am witnessing for Christ at this moment. I'm saying that I believe that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And I'm telling you that I know he was, and that he is alive today. But now, that's not the way people witness for Christ, is it? I've had people try to witness to Jesus or witness for Jesus to me. And they've come along and said, bless your brother, you know, have you given your heart to the Lord? Or a lot of times there's an almost saucy mannerism. It's almost as if they pull themselves up to their full Pharisaical religious heights and they say, I know this guy is going to be turned off by the manner in which I come on so strongly right here on the street corner when I hand him this little thing that says sign on the dotted line and go to heaven, but I'm going to do it anyhow. It's almost as if many people begin to convince themselves that if they go through the agony of this embarrassing public encounter, which they call witnessing for the Lord, that they're going to have the angels up there, pretty good job. He turned off a few more people and kind of taking notes, you know, on the payoff when they get up into heaven. Maybe they don't think that way, and I don't want to put anybody down. But it says here that they gave a powerful witness about what they had seen and heard. Now, you know, when you're on a witness stand, the judge wants to know, well, what did you see? What did you hear? What time was it? What did he do? Who was he? What did he look like? What were all the circumstances surrounding the event? What if a witness is on the stand and the judge says, now you're sworn in, you know what? Tell us in your own words what happened on the night of Friday the 13th. Oh, he was such a wonderful man. I think I covered that previously, so I don't want to belabor the point. But it'd be a dumb way to be saying that you're witnessing for something. But in verse 20, chapter 4 of the book of Acts, Peter said, we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. That's what they were talking about, what they had seen and what they had heard. In verse 33 of chapter 4, it says, with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Churches don't believe in a resurrection? That's their problem, not mine. I do. I know you should. I know the Bible says it is true. I know that I have proved it, and I can prove it, and so can you if you'll give yourself a chance. The church gained strong momentum. Thousands upon thousands of all nationalities began to accept the fact. That's historical proof, and it's historical proof of another point. That is that the church grew because of the continuing conviction. Let's put it this way. They, the people who listened, were convinced that the apostles were convinced. There was no doubt in their mind. Those people were talking positively. All right, 500 others saw Jesus after his resurrection. There was a period of 24 years where there were still many alive in Jerusalem who had seen Christ resurrected from the dead. If Paul, writing about the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, was telling a lie, why didn't hundreds, no, thousands, rise up and write things to the contrary? They did not. They didn't gainsay it. They couldn't. The fourth rule was Paul and the testimony of hostile witnesses, that hostile witnesses gave the same evidence as those trying to propagate the truth. You look at the chief antagonists of the church at its very beginning and the fanatic zeal that they had. And every intellectual argument to dispute the resurrection possible came along, and yet Paul himself, when he was first vehemently against the practical application of that religion, did a complete 180-degree turn and gave a powerful witness continually about the resurrection. What did it? A personal experience. And it wasn't just something that touched his heart. He was allowed to see an actual vision. He was blinded, and he was converted. And Paul, absolutely, overwhelmingly, was converted, repented totally of who and what he was, what he had been, what he had done, and called upon God to give him the strength to go out and to tell what he knew. Now, he'd been trained in Judaism. He was so fervent that it was said he absolutely turned the world upside down because of what he believed. These and many other historical rules support the absolute practical fact of Jesus' resurrection. It's no wonder that the only sign that Jesus ever gave, which would be a perennial, lasting testimony to the fact that he was the Messiah, was the sign of his resurrection. Then I ask, why don't the major churches believe that sign? Why don't they emphasize the resurrection? They can't, because it's difficult to take the idea of souls in heaven and bodies on earth and to reconcile the two, and more willing to hang on to their own cherished pagan fables and traditions instead of teach, preach, and believe what Jesus Christ actually said. They compromise. It's their problem, not mine. Doesn't need to be your problem, though. You write for these booklets, will you? After death, then what? What next? What will you be doing in the next life? Do you know? Is there any way to find out? You've never talked to a person who came back from the grave to be able to tell you, so where do you go? I know recently I was standing at a graveside ceremony where I had to talk to a few bereaved loved ones who were burying a father, and I said that the only thing I can do is to go to the Bible to see what it says about the state of the dead. I couldn't go to a scientific textbook. After all, even the Supreme Court can't really agree on when a person dies, what constitutes death, whether it's when your heart stops beating or your brain dies or something else. I went to the Bible. I went to the book of Job. It asked that same question, if a man die, shall he live again? I asked and I answered those questions from the book of Job, from the Bible. There are many, many scriptures, literally dozens, that talk about the state of the dead in the Bible. What is this thing called death? You write for this free booklet, After Death, What Then? Or just mention the one on death. It is free of charge. There is no price. It's absolutely biblical. You can check up and find out. You can underline, make notations in the margin of your own Bible. And when you finish reading this booklet, you will know. You'll have the Bible answers to that question. You'll probably know more about it than your minister does if you're not awful careful. I mean, you should probably stop short of that, but I'd want you to read the entirety of the booklet, read the whole thing, and find out what the Bible says about it. Jesus Christ is alive today. You need to prove that to yourself. Maybe find out what you ought to be doing about it. Don't put off writing for those booklets. All you need to do is to send your request to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Now, articles just like this Plain Talk, will be coming along in the Plain Truth magazine just about every single issue. You can have that kind of copy if you write for the Plain Truth. It's free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.